do we exist? Were we created with a purpose, or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. Join us as we seek to see a generation captivated and transformed by the truth of Christianity. This is The Universe Next Door.
Welcome to The Universe Next Door. I hope you're having a wonderful week. I certainly am, and we're kind of pivoting today and going in a different direction from what we've been doing the last few weeks or so with the Divine Counsel stuff. So go back and check that out, of course, if you haven't, just the series before this one. But what we're doing today is we're getting into more of the cultural slash societal slash even spiritual issues, and we're going to be talking about trans stuff today. And I would be willing to bet that the average Christian would probably agree, maybe not in front of certain people, but at least on a poll on the internet in private, would probably agree that a guy can't become a girl and a girl can't become a guy. But beyond that, if somebody were to press you on it or question you on it, you may not know what to say. And so what we're talking about today is, of course, looking at this from a scientific standpoint, looking into things such as puberty blockers and hormones that they're giving kids and just really doing things that are going to damage them and that are going to affect them very, very negatively for the rest of their lives. But we're also going to look at the side of it, I guess sort of the practical side of it. What do you do in a situation with your family or if you're at church or whatever it may be, and you have someone, you have, let's say, a eighth grade girl telling you that they want to switch genders, that they want to transition to be a boy. What are you actually going to do in that situation? How are you going to communicate to them in a way where they feel like they can trust you and they love you, but at the same time, you make your point and your view clear, especially during a time where the culture and even teachers at school and friends and social media and so on and so forth are going to be telling them the exact opposite and telling them with a lot of pressure. So it's one thing to be, you know, in disagreement with somebody. It's another thing to be in disagreement when you have adults and other people telling you that if you don't agree with this view, then you're evil or you're racist or you're sexist or you're bigoted. And that's what they're going to be hearing, and that's what they are hearing. So how are you going to prepare yourself for that? And how are you going to respond to that challenge that you absolutely are going to have to face if you haven't yet? Why has the number of people wanting to quote unquote transition gotten exponentially higher, especially teenage girls? And why is it more girls than guys? What are the contributing factors? How does social media play a part in this? How does cultural pressure play a part in this? How does psychology play a part in this? And even things like depression and anxiety and disorders and so on and so forth. So we're going to be getting into all of this fun, lighthearted stuff. But before we do that, make sure to hit follow wherever you're listening. And if you're on Apple, Spotify, etc., go ahead and hit the notify button under the menu or whatever it is. There should be a little notify button, and that will notify you of episodes. That's why it's called the notify button. But we generally release our episodes Tuesdays at 5 p.m., but we have extra content that comes out. We have a new segment coming up over the next few weeks. We're going to be starting YouTube as well, so we have a ton of new stuff coming up. But you don't want to miss any of it, so hit follow and hit notify. And thank you so much to those of you who give. And if you're thinking about giving, there's a button to do that. But aside from that, the other best way you can help us is by praying for us, by giving, or by sharing an episode on social media or with a friend. The best way to spread anything, let alone a podcast, is by word of mouth. And so if you would do that, and if you have done that, thank you so much. You are a huge blessing to us. But with that being said, let's get into our interview with Alicia Wood. Alicia Wood is a speaker at Apologetics, Inc., the same ministry that this podcast is a product of. She's been covering all kinds of apologetics topics for years, including nearly a decade at RZIM, and she is here today to talk to us about all things trans. Alicia, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, wonderful to speak with you today. Like you said, I was with RZM, you know, 8 years, and there's so many topics that I've had to address over the years. And the culture keeps changing and the culture keeps moving. And as apologists, we kind of just, you know, keep moving with them. What is the way that in, you know, this particular year, in this moment, we can share the same gospel message with a different twist based on where the culture is? So thanks for having me on to deal with this challenging topic.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. It's one that so many people are dealing with. It's growing rampantly and has been the last
a number of years, but it's also something people have to deal with on a practical level, where it isn't just a theological theory or a social theory anymore. It's like so many kids are wanting to transition, and adults too. So it's just something that nobody can escape anymore. When I was in high school or middle school, it was like, this was almost unheard of, I'm sure, mm-hmm. for you too, but it's just growing and growing, and it's right in your face now.
Oh yeah, absolutely unheard of. I mean, I think there was one young lady in my high school that maybe was a lesbian. That was it though. Like it wasn't, I mean, the trans stuff was nowhere was really on the radar. Neither was the LGBT stuff really even on the radar. So a lot of this is like, whoa, a lot of people are trying to sort out, what do we do? How do we process this? Because it can be new for so many people.
Yeah, I don't even know if the acronym existed. If it did, it was like really unknown, almost like an anomaly. But that is mm-hmm. that has entirely changed. And I think there's a lot of elements go into that. But I know today we were going to get into kind of some of the specifics revolving around it and also how to handle it. And before we do that, before I get carried away like I usually do, I wanted to ask you how you kind of got, like what your story is, how you got involved in apologetics. Obviously, with what you do and what you've done for years, I mean, you speak in front of crowds, you do live Q&As and all kinds of stuff. So how did you get started in that? How old were you at the time?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So I think honestly, I was one of those really weird kids that just had a lot of questions, and I still do. I just have questions about everything. I love to learn about everything. And so even though I grew up in the church, I just had questions about, you know, how do I explain this? Or how do I understand this? And I always want to go in deeper. I remember as a little kid, I don't even know how old, 7, 8, 9, whatever it was, but going around the church and trying to get people to answer these two questions for me. And the two questions were, what is a trinity? I can't quite understand how Jesus was on the cross, but God was in heaven. Like that just didn't make any sense to me. And then my second one was, what if there was no God, what would there be? Because there couldn't just be space, because space is like made up of something and it's empty. It wouldn't have a color, like the color would be black, but then somebody had to create the color black. Like I was trying to sort these things out as a kid and I just couldn't. I just couldn't figure out how to do that. And I didn't get good answers either when I asked people in church. So that just kind of gives you a little bit of a glimpse as to what kind of kid I was. And then I became a criminal justice major, which is basically, you know, looking at clues and evidence and seeing where that leads you. So I think I just took kind of like that same mindset of investigative stuff. I grew up reading Encyclopedia Brown books and took that same investigative mind to Christianity. And I think it's just how I'm wired is to look at the Christian story in this way. What can I learn? What can I know? Where does the evidence point? What can I conclude? Logic and reason and all of these kind of things.
Now, did you have like, I don't know exactly where you grew up and in what denomination and everything, but did you ever feel like you just, there were questions you couldn't ask or that you weren't allowed to ask and it was almost like inappropriate, or was it just, you just had questions and couldn't get answers?
So there was just, it was a lot of questions. Sorry, you said like, say that again, sorry.
Like, you know, how a lot of people will say, it's almost kind of like a cliche thing at this point, but I could never get my questions answered, or I felt like I wasn't allowed to ask certain questions.
Yeah. It was more that I definitely didn't feel like I wasn't allowed. I just felt like people didn't have answers. Like I would ask them and people didn't necessarily know. Now there was a lot that I did, that they did know. I mean, a lot of my Christian foundation is from Sunday school classes. And, you know, when I was a kid, a lot that they did know, but I, you know, I also didn't know about the world of theology when I was a kid. You know, when it came to the question as a teenager of, I was trying to think through, why would God allow suffering? I didn't know about philosophy books. I didn't know about theology books. I just had the Bible. So I would just dig through the Bible to see what answers can I come up with? You know, so I was also didn't understand the greater world of knowledge and things that were out there either. So I think, you know, people were willing to answer, but I don't think they fully knew.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cause I mean, I got saved when I was 20. And any questions I had, I thought I knew the answer to already. Turns out I was wrong about all of them. But no, it's just a story that you hear a lot. And that with our youth group at our church and even our young adult ministry, we always encourage people to ask questions. And it's the same reason we do a Q&A on here every month. It's like, if you have questions, ask them. Like we always tell younger people at church, if you think you have a stupid question and you don't ask it, then you're still stupid because you don't know the answer to the question you thought was stupid. So, and of course that's a joke, but it's better to ask it and to learn and to know and to have an environment where you can do that.
Exactly. I fully agree. Yeah. And be okay if you don't have an answer, you know, especially as an apologist. A lot of times people think that apologists and theologians and philosophers that we all have the answers. It's like, no, actually, we're actually probably a bit more comfortable with not knowing the answer. It's also part of the search and the discovery that we enjoy. What can we uncover, and what can we, how much closer to the real answer can we get? And so sometimes you don't get answers. A lot of times you don't get answers yet. Maybe you will in 5 years.
Yeah. And there's so many things where even when you have an answer, it's like, this is what we do know about it, but you can't fully grasp it. Like the Trinity or the nature of Christ or yes. Like you were even asking when you were a kid, it's like, how can Jesus be here and the Father be here? And it's like, yeah. This whole Trinity thing, just someone gives you an answer and you're even more confused.
Right.
Okay. So speaking of questions with difficult answers, how do you think we got to the point that we are now where, you might have the statistics in front of you, I don't, but with so many students, with so many kids specifically, I mean, adults too, but especially kids wanting to transition or quote unquote transition from boy to girl or from girl to boy. This just seems something that's so foreign to so many people to have to deal with. But how do you think we kind of got to where we are today? Why is it accelerated at such a quick rate?
Yeah. Okay. So that is a much larger question, but for the sake of time, I'm going to skip a lot of the pre-stuff. I mean, I think you can go back to the sexual revolution. You can go back even further than that. But this idea of, first of all, that we have been, wrestling, I think, as a culture with sexuality, with identity, with freedoms, and various things like that, that, you know, we have the ability to control certain things that maybe really are outside of our ability. But I think what makes the current transgender movement so interesting, because it's not new in the sense of, like, people were transitioning. I mean, it's usually male to female. We didn't usually see female to male. But it was typically male to female that, you know, 2 to 4 years old, and they're kind of like, they believe they're a girl. So, like, if you think about TLC's I'm Just Jazz Jennings, that whole story, that's probably more your typical one where they feel from a young age that they're a girl, and then they kind of go from there. But what's been interesting with what's happened in the last several years is that we've had a massive spike in female to male. And that's what's unheard of, or that's what's very unusual. So a couple things that might be helpful. That 1.8% of people under 18 are identifying as transgender as of 2021. So that's double 5 years prior, which is a big, massive amount of increase that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And from 2016 to 2017, the gender surgeries for female to male increased by 4 times. And they now make up of 70% of gender surgeries. So, and then in the UK, in 2018, they saw a staggering rise in female to male gender treatments of 4,400%. Those last two studies came from Abigail Schreier's Irreversible Damage book, which I think is a really helpful resource on this. So what you're seeing is a massive shift in what's happening, where young girls are beginning to struggle with identifying as a boy. And so they've had to go through a bunch of different reasons to try and see, where is this coming from? And, you know, we know the effects of social media, first of all, because what's often happening is young girls are saying, hey, I'm not comfortable being a girl, and or I'm not happy with my life, or I'm depressed, or I'm anxious, or whatever. And they get on social media, and basically person social media tells them, the reason why you don't like yourself is because you're a boy. And look, I felt like that before, and now I've transitioned and I'm so much happier. And so that's kind of been what's helped push a lot of this forward, as one piece of it. Yeah.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I covered a little bit of this aspect of it when we had Billboard Chris on a couple months ago, which, mm-hmm. by the way, that series earned me more unfollows than any other. This will happen again today too. So
oh no.
Thanks for picking that. I'm just kidding. that's why we're here. We're here to talk about the uncomfortable things. But I think that is a huge factor, where in our society, obviously, girls and boys both face different difficulties and different, yes. social pressures. But for girls to now be told that it's like, hey, if you're a girl, it's not fair. I mean, if you're a guy, it'd be so much better. And so now there's an added societal pressure of teaching girls that they're supposed to be boys, mm-hmm. If they like to do boy things. I mean, if my daughter likes football, then who cares? She can play football or skateboard, right. or whatever we consider right. boyish things. But you did say that in the past, it was more common for boys to want to transition to girl, and now it's girls to want to do it.
Yeah. Well, what you said, I think, is actually really key, right? So I grew up a tomboy. I was always the kid that wanted to do sports over any of the girly type things. I wasn't into makeup and pretty dresses and nails. It wasn't my thing. I wanted to play dodgeball with the boys, right? So And so what we just did is we called them tomboys. I was called a tomboy. I was always a tomboy. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like, hey, that must mean you're a boy because you do these certain things. These are social cultural type things that we now are placing on young girls to say, well, look, if you like these things, you must be a boy. So here's the thing that people need to understand is what they found with the current trans movement and the rise in young women that are transitioning is they found it's not so much that the young girls want to be boys, it's that they don't want to be girls. So in other words, there's issues with them wanting to be a girl. So then you alluded to it, right? Like life will be better with a boy. You'll get paid more money for your job. You won't be discriminated against. Many of these girls are, you know, told childbirth is horrible and they're scared of that. They're scared of getting periods. Some of them have experienced abuse. And so they feel like if I'm a boy, well, I can protect myself better or I won't get abused. And so that's another thing. Maybe they are tomboys and they're bullied for being masculine women. And that kind of thing, you know, that also is. So there's a variety of reasons why women are switching over. One of the issues that the LGB community has with the T part is that first they're concerned that parents are raising their children, their young girls, as boys because they're actually lesbians. And so one of the things that they're also discovering is that one of the reasons why these young girls might want to be transitioning is because they're really lesbian and they don't want to be. So if they're a boy, then they're no longer gay. They're actually heterosexual. And so that is another thing that they're finding is part of the reasons why these young girls don't want to be girls anymore.
I want to say the vast majority of households now, they don't have two parents. A lot of, I guess what traditionally was there has changed and is missing in regard to the influence from a father or the influence from a mother. Like, it just seems like a totally different world. But as far as getting earlier, it seems like there's a lot of children who are now being groomed and being taught that, like you were saying, if you like to do boy stuff and you're a girl, you should just be a boy. And this age seems to be getting earlier and earlier. It seems to be really enforced, not just by the public school system, but by the school system as a whole. We've covered that on the show too. Mm-hmm. But as far as I guess what they would call quote unquote treatments, which I don't think are treatments at all, but puberty blockers, mm-hmm. And surgeries and that sort of thing. What do we know about puberty blockers? Like, where do they come from? What are they supposed to be used for? And what kind of effects do puberty blockers have on children when they start to grow up and have this sort of irreversible damage?
Yeah, irreversible damage is the title of Abigail Schreier's book. Exactly.
Who is it? I'm going to link it in the description.
Yeah, so Abigail Schreier, she wrote the book Irreversible Damage, and she's really the one that really exposed it. Abigail's not a Christian, as far as I can tell. I think probably she might consider herself a liberal Jew. Excuse me, Abigail, if you're listening, but I believe that might be how she'd identify. But she's not a Christian, but she was a journalist and basically people came to her and said, you need to write on this. And she's like, what is this that you're talking about? And she's the one who kind of looked into it and began to discover that, looking at a study by another woman named Lisa Littman, this idea of rapid onset gender dysphoria, where what's happening, and I will get to your puberty blockers thing, but this is going to tie into that, where these young girls essentially have no, unlike the men who start, you know, maybe 2-4 years old feeling like they're trans, these young girls don't have that at all. They don't have the feeling at all from a young age that they're boys. And then all of a sudden during puberty or maybe pre-puberty, they all of a sudden feel like they're a boy. And their parents are like, where did this come from? It seems like it's so out of nowhere. And so the parents, of course, don't know what to do. And so this is where Lisa Littman, she started noticing this behavioral pattern that girls would transition even in groups. Where one girl would come out and then as trans and then all of her other girlfriends would come out as trans. So girls are trans becoming boys in groups. And it's like, this is weird. So that's where it became a social contagion. They use those kind of phrases and the rapid onset where it suddenly comes on. But this one of the common things that they found is what I call them like the golden four. But they're finding that these young girls are struggling with at least one of four conditions. Depression, anxiety, ADHD, autism. And so they're already struggling with these things when they go to their parents and say, I need help. So they go to their parents, say that they're a man, or they leave their boy, and the parents like, where did this come from? So they send them to the therapist, and maybe they've changed their names. Maybe they've gone on social media and they told them, you know, you're a boy and you'll be fine. And so that's why they're going to their parents. I'm a boy. You know, all these things could have been playing in the background. And the therapist, after one, maybe two visits, sends them to an endocrinologist who puts them on puberty blockers. So now we're getting to your question. So puberty blockers, essentially, we have used them in the past. Puberty blockers have been used for young girls that start their periods early, maybe 8, 9 years old, and they'll put you on them for about a year to kind of buy you a year of time. But to do it at the long term as what we're doing now, putting people in these things for years, that is not something that we've done before. We're essentially trying this out live, where it's a live human experiment, essentially is what it is. So let me tell you a little bit about what it is, the effects of puberty blockers. It first of all, it does essentially what it says. It stops puberty where it's at. So if you are 11 years old, it stops it there. If you are 13, it stops it there. And it's going to stop delay your height, right? It's going to slow your bone growth, which is going to affect your height. It's going to delay the start of a period because your puberty, if you're 11, you haven't gotten it yet, it's going to start delay that as well. It's going to stop that from happening. But the puberty blockers are just like a temporary thing, because after being on puberty blockers for a certain period of time, usually young girls are like, well, we want to go to the next step, or young boys are like, we want to go to the next step. And that's when they get into the cross-sex hormones. And now we bring in a whole nother set of things.
And so puberty blockers were intended to, for, like you said, girls who are going through puberty early, it's intended to delay that so they can have time to develop properly. And then they'll go through puberty a little bit later. But now what right. they're doing is they're actually trying to use it to block puberty, like period.
Exactly.
Like, we want to keep you from transitioning from a girl to a woman. And so that way we can do whatever's going to come next. And those procedures are not cheap, by the way. I'm not going to be happy if we start paying for them, but they're supposed to be delaying it so that they can healthily grow in the way that their body is designed to grow. And obviously going through puberty would be early would be something that's not supposed to happen health wise. But these are now being misused to actually stop kids from going to puberty.
Exactly, right? So now you're giving them to 15-year-olds, right? Which by that point, you should be, a healthy 15-year-old should be going through puberty, or you're giving to 13-year-olds who mm-hmm. should be starting, right? So now this is the body's normal developmental pathway that now we're halting. And actually, just a side note, they are, if anybody's from the UK, there's been issues with the NHS, the National Health Service, there in the UK, because they have universal healthcare, that they have had to pay for transition surgeries, and then people detransition out, and all of this is on the NHS system. So people, there has been some challenges with that. So why is it that they are paying for all of these procedures?
Now, how common is it? I had a question I was going to ask off of the puberty blocker thing, so don't let me forget. But how common is it for people to try to do a transition, whether it's puberty blockers or surgery, and then want to reverse it? Like, do we have any kind of reliable statistics on that, or roughly speaking?
So we don't yet on what's called detransitioners. And part of it is because it's actually happening now, right? So we had the wave of people transitioning. And so that happened. And really the spike, you're going to see the spike in all of this happening starting around 2012, which is incidentally right when social media, you know, you put iPhones in the hands of young girls, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to see, and they have access to social media and these kind of things. So you're going to see this movement over the last 10 or so years, increasing and increasing. And then you get to the point where now people are actually living it. And now this is when we start to see whether or not people are staying, right? So the detransition thing is happening. Now, of course, there's detransitioners before, but in terms of the mass level of what we're seeing, so I don't know of any studies that are out yet. I'm sure they're working on them and they're doing them right now to see, but the detransitioners are very loud. Like, they're on social media. Chloe Cole is a very vocal one. She is, in fact, if anybody wants to get further research on this, I totally recommend the Jordan Peterson and Chloe Cole interview, where she sits down with Jordan Peterson, and you get to see Jordan Peterson as a therapist, as a psychologist, speaking to a patient. And she'll talk about her story and detransitioned at a very young age. She transitioned at a young age and detransitioned at a young age. By the time she was, I think, 17 or 18, she detransitioned. So they're loud. They're trying to warn people. They're speaking in front of Congress. They're on social media. And it's funny because once you detransition, you're no longer part of the trans community, and they turn on them very quickly.
Yeah. No, and that's how the mob works. It's like you think you're part of this thing until you're not useful, and then you're done. And I think it's actually significant that you pointed out that this is really a live experiment. It hasn't been going on for long. And I would suggest there have been a whole lot of live experience the last few years or so that we've been a part of. But as far as the social media goes, now that I have two kids, I'm like the authority. I can say whatever I want on this and no one can disagree. But I would suggest that either kids don't have social media, or B, if you're a parent and you're listening, that you have a like very good grip on what they're seeing and listening to and what the filters are and everything, because it's kind of like a double-edged sword. You have the one side of it where they're getting all of this unlimited content. And I could go for hours on all the effects of this, like with TikTok and Instagram Reels and even YouTube Shorts, just one after another, after another, after another. You're wondering why your kids can't focus. Well, that's one of the main reasons. But you have that part of it where they're just being fed so much content in short little pieces that they're going to remember that you have no idea what they're seeing. And on the other side of it, you have social media in general causing depression and anxiety, to where in our church, we go to camp once a year with the youth students. And when we go, like not having their phone at camp was a deal breaker for some of them. Like some of them didn't go because it's no longer just, oh, come on, you can get away from your phone. It's a part of them.
Yes. Like
they're used to, it's part of your brain. You can't get anywhere without it. Anytime you have a question, you look it up instead of critically thinking. It just affects so many things. And it's like this big whirlwind of like playing into the anxiety and depression in different ways. But that's a good point, the social media.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, and part of the challenge that young children have, or young teenagers, I guess you could say, have, is that is a lot of their social circle. So when you take the phone away, you're actually like, they don't have any other communication with their friends, right? Because friends aren't hanging out. Friends are just at home on the phones. And so it's like a lose-lose kind of situation. Because if the social media is making them depressed, then you want to take them away from that stuff. But then because they're not engaging with their friends, now they feel lonely. So it's a very tough thing. But one thing they'll tell you is if you are a parent and you are, your child comes to you and says that they believe that they're trans, I mean, one of the main things that somebody's going to tell you is get them off social media. Get them off social media. They'll tell you, send them to grandma's house for 3 months. You know, where they can't, we don't have access to those things, change their schools, change their friend circles. In other words, change their environment, and you'd be surprised, all of a sudden they don't feel trans anymore. This is very much a social contagion. It's very much, these young girls are influenced, just the way the girls work, right? We feed off of each other and we sense somebody's emotions and we respond accordingly. Men have a different interaction, but girls feed off each other and they empathize with each other and they identify with each other's pain and they jump into each other's stories. And so once they're away from all of that, then it really changes how they think about themselves and how they view themselves. So yeah, getting them off social media is totally a go if this is something that your child's struggling with.
Yeah, that's a good point too. And it's just like we see in 1 Corinthians, which is actually a quote from a secular philosopher, by the way, but that bad company corrupts good character.
Good character.
Mm-hmm. And that's always true. Everyone thinks their kid is going to be the one to go off to the university or to the wherever it is and be the one who's going to be the shining light and everyone's going to get saved around them. And 99 out of 100 times it happens the other way around. And it doesn't have to. Wherever you're sending your kid, just make sure they're equipped and they're prepared. That's what we do here. But it's difficult for somebody to have to be like the Daniel in the lion's den. It's so unlikely that'll actually happen. And more times than not, when you're just surrounded by certain views, and not only certain views, but having those views just kind of in your face. And it's like, if you don't agree with this, you're racist or you're sexist or you're bigoted. And you have this pressure that we didn't have really, to this degree. And I could talk all day again about the reasons for that and things that play into it. But the reality is it's there and we have to do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and the problem with this whole issue is that this isn't just, hey, you know, my child wants to play baseball and then they change their mind the next year and they want to play, you know, soccer or something. Mm. Like once we're with this issue, you know, we're actually giving medication to people. And these things are not reversible in many regards. And so we are actually creating lifelong challenges for people based off of the decisions that we're making, right? And this is where, you know, it's really, really hard for parents, right? Because they're like, we don't know what to do with this. And so they trust the therapist, but the therapists are, their hands are tied because they can't speak against it. I mean, look at all the challenges Jordan Peterson has had with keeping his license, you know, in Canada. Like they feel like they're handcuffed. And then they go to the endocrinologist and they may feel handcuffed or they may support it, whichever way it is. The point is that they're getting, you know, these strong drugs like testosterone and estrogen, which alters them and impacts them for their entire life. And those impacts are irreversible in most cases.
Yeah. And for somebody to, especially a doctor, to actually go through with that, knowing that A, they either don't have all the information or B, the information they do have is not what they're pretending it is disturbing to say the least. But speaking of that, we talked a little bit about puberty blockers, but how about hormones like testosterone or estrogen or other things that they're giving to people? What do we know about that and what kind of effects that may have?
Well, so here's one of the things with testosterone. That remember I said they're kind of generally suffering from one of the golden four: anxiety, depression, autism, ADHD. Okay. So they're already suffering from certain kind of mental health things before they even identify as trans, right? These are kind of the precursors for the overwhelming majority of these young girls. So here's the thing. They get put on testosterone, and testosterone can be helpful to relieve anxiety and depression. So that's what testosterone does. So now they get testosterone and they say, look, I'm feeling better. See, I am a boy. That's what this is. And it almost gives them like a false positive in a sense, like you just keep going this direction, it's going to get better. But that's just the effect of the drug, actually, of just relieving your anxiety and depression. And so then it leads women to be more bold, leads women to be more unafraid, you know, kind of maybe some of the characteristics that we apply to men, but it can affect your short-term memory. It can affect moodiness. It can affect irritability. And more so, the things that I think are really concerning to me are the fact that, you know, it affects your body hair, right? So testosterone given to testosterone in teenage boys, right? They start to grow facial hair and increase in body hair. So that's what it does to young teenage girls, right? It's going to grow their body. It's going to deepen their voice. The hair is irreversible when even if just a few short months on testosterone, the impact of the growth of hair, that is irreversible. The voice changing is irreversible even when you go off these drugs, even when you go off testosterone. The baldness, the premature baldness, someone get like a receding hairline, I should say, that is irreversible. Testosterone also, and many young girls are not told this, but testosterone also brings about growth of female genitalia. And that is permanent as well, even after you're on, even after you leave the testosterone. That's one of the things that detransitioners would talk about, is they had no idea what it would do to their body and the things that they couldn't fix and things they couldn't change. And so the way the body reallocates fat can shift. So there's all of these things that happen as a result of testosterone that these young girls are not told. Muscle aches, increased sweating, aggression. And then, of course, what is really bad is you can get endometrial cancer. And this is a well-known thing that this increased testosterone causes cancer. It causes increased risk of cancer in young girls. And that's why you see after just a few short years on testosterone, doctors will begin, about 5 years, they'll begin to suggest that they actually get a hysterectomy. And it's to prevent them from getting cancer. So now what happens is now you're in your early 20s and you have been sterilized, essentially. Now you can't have children. And what science has shown us, what the studies show, is that by the time somebody's in their mid-20s is when they kind of come to the point where they actually like themselves. Like, okay, I'm actually cool with my body. I'm actually cool with my hair. I'm actually cool with my height. I'm actually cool with whatever. But the problem is that now they look down at their bodies and they've mutilated them. And that's when the detransitioning starts to happen. And so that's when they start to say, what have I done? Because I'm not happier. And now I don't like what I've done. And the reason why they're not happier is because nobody treated their mental health, which was always the problem in the first place. It was never that they needed to be a boy, it's that they were suffering from these conditions.
Yeah, and that's so unfortunate, because you have these underlying conditions that people have, like anxiety, like depression, ADD, autism, the things you listed. And these are real things that have to be dealt with and have to be treated. And they're not. You just have this Band-Aid solution, except it's like underneath the Band-Aid, like whatever they put the Band-Aid on is just rotting and getting even worse. It's just, you can't see it. And it really is disturbing, because there may be there may be something that could either be fixed with medication in regard to depression, right, or anxiety, or even a spiritual issue. Like a lot of the time, people don't recognize or know the gospel. They haven't heard the gospel. And I'm not saying that the gospel promises that you won't suffer or have depression. I mean, guys like Charles Spurgeon had depression. I mean, people in the Bible had depression. So I'm not saying that's all gone, but to understand there's a bigger purpose to your life is like the start of trying to either fix these things or get them to a manageable level rather than just go to the other extreme, which is, hey, you can just be a different person and that'll probably solve it.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that is a good, So that brings me to like, how do we deal with this? Because, you know, can God give us any help in this? And one thing I neglected to say is I didn't talk about estrogen and boys. And one thing I would say, I mean, amongst many things, I mean, it does cause estrogen in young boys does cause growth of their chest. So they grow breasts, right? It's a feminization of young boys. And these things are not reversible. And that's what people need to understand. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I think this is why I find, you know, it's one of those things where if you identify the wrong problem, you will treat the wrong problem, right? And I think we think in our minds as, hey, you know, something is wrong with the body. My mind is okay. My mind tells me I'm a female. Something is wrong with my body because it came out. Let me say this again. I'm talking about me. My mind tells me I'm a male, but my body's female. Something's wrong with my body. It didn't get it right. So I just need to change my body and align it with my head. And we're left with, which one do we listen to? Do we listen to the head? Was the head right? Or is the body right? Right? When the LGB community, years back, Christians would talk about conversion therapy. You know, Exodus International was a big thing. And what that essentially did is it took somebody who said, hey, I'm same-sex attracted, and it tried to deal with their mind. Let's correct the mind. Well, we said that was really bad. We step back from conversion therapy and say it's really bad. So now what we're doing with trans thing is we're not trying to correct the mind, because we already went through the conversion thing and it was a bad thing. So what are we doing now? Now we're trying to correct the body. And so we're still fixing the wrong thing. And I think you're right. I think, you know, there are spiritual aspects to this, or there's just, I think in our culture, it's so hard for us to like who we are, to like ourselves. Puberty is already a very uncomfortable time for people. And they don't know how they're supposed to look, because everybody on Instagram looks prettier than them, or looks happier than them, or there's more handsome than them. Mm-hmm. And they don't like themselves. I don't look like them. I'm not as good of an athlete as he is. I'm not as good of, my hair isn't as great as hers is. And all of these comparisons that we do are not good for our mental health, because we've lost the ability to find ourselves beautiful. And this is where I think it's like almost like in God's infinite wisdom that he somehow knew that we would struggle with liking ourselves. You know, and in the very first chapter of the Bible, he puts like, in the image of God, they were made male and female. He made them, right? And this whole idea of like, there is something unique and special about humanity, different than any other species, right? Jesus didn't die on the cross for the owls. He died on the cross for humanity. There's something unique about us, but also you were shaped, you were created, you were formed. That's what the Hebrew talks about there in Genesis chapter 1. You were shaped, you were formed male or female. It's physical. You're female because of a physical description. You're male because of a physical description. From the very beginning, he tried to help us through this confusion.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And of course, people could try to make the argument that, well, sin has corrupted everything, so why couldn't it have corrupted gender? But that's because there's now this made up view that there's a difference between gender and sex.
Right.
As though you can have like your brain can be in the wrong body, but that's just not the reality. Men and women are different in so many ways, as you pointed out. They're created to be different.
But that's
just something that I think has confused a lot of people and thrown a lot of people off, especially when you hear somebody with like a PhD or something say, well, yeah, there's gender and there's sex. Do you know the difference? And it causes a lot of confusion, but that's not a real issue. That's not a real thing.
Right.
And so it's really based off of a premise that doesn't make sense. It's just like, you can't accidentally be born an animal or an alien, or there's just some things that don't fall into that category. And an example of the effect of sin could be something like gender dysphoria. I don't think that that's always made up. Mm-hmm. I think that there have always been people who have struggled with that. And over the last however many years, it's all of these other factors have poured in that weren't there before. But yeah, I think that's so significant for people to understand that you were created for a purpose. You were created not to be somebody else. You can learn from other people and gain from other people, but like, you're yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And this brain body differentiation that we've made actually doesn't really exist. So Dr. Deborah So, who wrote the book, The End of Gender, can be really helpful here. And she is an atheist and considers herself more liberal than Bernie Sanders. Like, she is not at all remotely Christian, but she studied, I think it's some kind of, I forget what her PhD is in, but something in neuroscience, neurobiology, I don't even know, but something along those lines. Anyways, but she's really helpful here because she talks about when you study like how a baby is formed in utero, one of the things that you learn is 7-8 weeks in utero, if they're male, the testosterone begins to masculinize their brain, which means from the 7-8 week mark, while they're still inside their mother's stomach, the testosterone is impacting their brain and masculinizing it. So this idea that you could be born physically male, but your brain be something else actually doesn't compute from a biological perspective, because that happened before you even came out that your brain was masculinized.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And and another difference is that women generally experience more negative emotion than men.
Yes.
Men are often more aggressive. And that's why a lot of the time you'll see men want to handle things physically, which isn't always a great idea. But but there are differences that these things play into. And the answer isn't just be a guy or be a girl instead. And like you said, I didn't know that about testosterone. I didn't know that it can kind of alleviate depression and that kind of thing. I had no idea about that, but
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why from a biological perspective, a lot of this is like a lot of biologists are like, what are we talking about here? Right. Because that's not how the biology lines up. It's not how we understand the human body. It's not how we understand development. That's not what's happening on a hormonal level. I mean, and so, yeah, there's a lot of things that people are saying, but it actually doesn't line up with science, believe it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's important. Like we were talking about before the show, it's not just a religious issue. Of course, apart from Christianity, there's really no argument for how your life has true purpose. That you can kind of create your own version of meaning, but it doesn't actually mean anything when you die and the earth burns out and everything's over.
Exactly.
But at the same time, there are scientific reasons, like we've talked about this whole episode. This isn't just, well, I'm Christian, so it's wrong. Of course, God is the one who gives us the moral code. He's the only one who can. But even aside from that, just logically, it doesn't make sense. Physiologically, it doesn't make sense. It's not healthy for anybody. And so there are all these factors in addition to that, which is important for people to recognize.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind is so much of what we're saying determines whether male or female are social constructs, right? So like we said before, a young girl who maybe she likes to do sports and she doesn't like to play Barbies, that she's somehow male. And then a young boy who likes to play with dolls, well, he's somehow female. Well, here's the thing we need to understand. And you're seeing these social constructs play into what it means to be a man or woman as an adult. So when we say like, I feel like, so let's talk about me. I feel like a boy, even though I'm born female, I feel like a boy, then I'm going to do certain things then physically to make me like a boy, right? And that's the whole point of the surgeries, right? The surgery goes that extra step. But here's the thing. When you look at somebody that's like Caitlyn Jenner, for example, okay? And when Caitlyn says, I want to be a female, born male, I want to be a female, what does Caitlyn do? Caitlyn gets breast enhancements. Caitlyn wears high heels. Caitlyn wears tight, small, tight dresses. Caitlyn paints their nails, right? So you've got all of long hair, right? And so here is the challenging thing with that. Essentially, what Caitlyn is saying is all there is to be a woman is high heels, some nice nails, some long hair, some makeup, you know, slim dress. And essentially, you're feeding into the cultural stereotypes and undoing, you know, years of feminism that says women are more than just their physical attributes, right? Any of this stuff, anytime a man is transitioning into a female and doing these physical changes, they're saying all I need to be as a female is to have these certain things, that there's no other underlying character. There's no other in meaning or definition or understanding that goes deeper than just how she looks physically. So is a girl with short hair not a girl? Is a girl who doesn't wear makeup not a girl? Is a girl with short nails not a girl? And so these are feeding into really poor cultural stereotypes that are not healthy for us at all as a society.
Yeah, and not only is there that factor, but it's also Bruce Jenner on his first year being a woman won the best woman of the year.
Yes.
First try. And so it's like, but yeah, that's so important that it's that women are unique and men are unique. And it just robs, like, you have the feminist movement, which I disagree with on the, or at least the third wave feminist movement, I disagree with on the vast majority of things, but at least at the very core of it, you have this idea that women are unique. And whether I agree on the details that women are unique and special and should get this or that, whatever it is, but is it that, or is it that I can just, if I feel like using another bathroom or having another benefit or whatever, I can just say I'm a woman, or I can just put on a wig, or not even put on a wig. I can just say, well, I'm a woman. And which one is it? Can anybody just be a woman and there's nothing special about women?
Exactly.
Or is it that women are unique?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's important to recognize that because it's a contradiction. And I think that's why sometimes you see the third wave feminist movement and the LGBT, I don't remember all the, everyone always says the alphabet thing. I don't remember all the letters. No one does, but that's why you have them. They don't always work together because it's going to end up in a contradiction.
Yeah, exactly. And many people who are outspoken against the T part of the LGBTQIA is because the LGB community is kind of like, wait a minute, what is this? What are we doing to children? Like, what's going on here? You know, there are a lot of the vocal ones. There's Gays Against Groomers is one of the ones that comes to mind, where it's a group of people who are same-sex attracted who identify as gay or lesbian, and they're vocal about, what are we doing to our children? This isn't okay. You know, from a biological level, you know, archaeologists have been digging up skeletons for years. They can look at a skeleton just by looking at the skeleton, looking at the shape of the skull, or looking at the hips, they can tell whether it's male or female. Men and women have different skulls. We have different bone structures in our skulls and in our hips. Women have wider hips, and their hips are made in order for childbearing. It's what makes men faster, actually, is that men's hips are shaped differently. It's why they can run faster, because of the way their center of gravity is in comparison to a woman. And so they, from just a skeletal perspective, we look fundamentally different. And so you can change, you can put on the dress, you can do all of these external things. And so, but it's not going to fundamentally change what you are. And I think that's what ultimately the Christian message is. It's not one where I'm wanting you to be like, you're a stupid person. Why would you think that? No, this is no different for me than dealing with somebody else who has a different position on me, who doesn't hold my Christian view. It's just like anything else. What I want somebody to know who's struggling with transgenderism or identifies as trans is, I don't want you to live in a reality that isn't real. I want you to live in truth. And you can tell yourself things, you can make these changes, but it can't fundamentally change who you are. And really the Christian perspective or the Christian attitude should always be, how can I help bring them into relationship with the Lord, with relationship with God, that he can help work and the Holy Spirit can work in them to help them to see things through a lens more clearly, you know? And that's really what I think the Christian perspective has to be, not to mock and criticize and make hateful posts and do it. I mean, that's just unproductive and it's not godly, you know, but ultimately you want somebody to live in their true meaning and their purpose and to understand their identity and their value and their worth of the eyes of God, that he loves them that much that he would die for them, and their confusion that they're dealing with and the depression and them not liking themselves. Like, that's not how I want anybody to live. And so that has to be our message for sure. It's complete compassion on this.
Yeah. Amen. And with that being said, you have this idea that, like, so many people are after comfort, and we all are, and comfort's important, but it doesn't take the place of truth. And it doesn't trump truth. If you want true comfort, you still need truth. It's kind of like that was one of the main issues. I think this is years ago, but when the book or the movie The Shack came out, it's like, well, it brought a lot of people a lot of comfort, and there were good elements to it. But then you have this stuff that's like the Trinity that's all messed up, and these other theological points. And it's kind of that same thing where it's like, it seems like it's going to make you comfortable, but if it isn't true, it's not ultimately going to make you comfortable. So how do we handle this as Christians? You've mentioned a couple things so far, but let's say you had like a family in your church or your youth group or young adult group or whatever, and you have somebody who, let's say, is a girl in like eighth grade and wants to identify as a boy. I don't think there's just one perfect answer for this, and everybody's different, but where do you even start? Like, how do you approach that with saying, okay, I want to care about this person.
Right.
I want to be compassionate, but I'm not going to lie to them. If they're a girl, I don't want to pretend they're a boy because I'd be lying. I don't want to tell them things that aren't true. Like, how do you balance, I want to be there for this person and love them, and also do it by telling them the truth?
Yeah. So I think it's a both and. I think, you know, if somebody's about to step off a cliff, you tell them, hey, don't do that, right? So I think you can tell them, hey, you know what? Let me sit down and talk with you about, tell me first, where are you at, right? Listen first to hear their story, hear where they're at, hear why they maybe are struggling or whatever's going on, right? Get their perspective and their understanding. So I would first do that. Listen to them. If they're struggling with any kind of mental health things, I would, you know, encourage them to find a good, solid therapist who isn't interested in just converting them, but transitioning them, but someone who's actually willing to deal with their real issues. You know, Doran Peterson, Chloe Cole interview is exactly that, where he sits down and he becomes her therapist. You know, had he had her at 12 or 13, it would have been a completely different outcome for her life. Chloe, let me tell you why you're feeling this. Chloe, let me tell you what was going on in your head. That's the kind of therapist you want that's going to help them sort through that. So that would be one thing. I would listen to them and I would deal with the mental health that they probably are struggling with, those mental health issues. And I would also let them know, hey, guess what? You may not be clear on what you are, or you may feel this. I can tell you that your creator knows best how you are to live and function and what your identity is. And I would share with them, you know, what it is that the Lord says. But then I wouldn't become, I think we start to lose footing when we start like forcing people and badgering people. I think we have to journey with people. I don't think it's something you could just tell people and then just send them off and you get mad because they don't do what you say. Well, hello, if somebody walks into your grocery store and tells you, hey, you need to be an atheist and gives you five reasons, are you just going to convert in that moment? Like, we need to, like, that's not how it works. Like, some people who come to Christians, it takes a process. So the same thing with somebody struggling with any kind of particular issue, right? It's a process. And so I think we walk people. I think you demonstrate Christ in a loving way. And I'm a firm believer of not trying to make people live like Christ before they like Christ, you know? So we need to, you know, help people to understand the gospel, lead them in that direction and allow the Holy Spirit to do his work. But I think we say it, we speak the truth in those situations as well.
Yeah. And of course, when you're like, let's say you're speaking in front of a crowd and somebody asks you a question, you might have 90 seconds or whatever, a few minutes. But if it's somebody in your church, you might be able to befriend that person and get to know them. And it doesn't have to be like a this needs to happen tomorrow thing. Of course, right. you want to tell them the truth. I would never suggest lying or anything like that. But I use an analogy where if someone were in a car accident or something and they were like dying. Like let's say their heart is stopped, actually their heart stopped and they also have like a big cut on their leg that's bleeding and like a couple other injuries. Like if I'm a paramedic, the first thing I'm going to do is like, before I deal with the cut on the leg or whatever else it is, I'm going to try to revive them first. Like I'm going to work on getting their heart beating. And it's the same thing. It's of course, morality is important, but someone who identifies as gay or trans, and they become the most straight person on the earth. And you're still going to hell if you don't.
You're still going to hell
if you don't believe the gospel. And so
exactly.
And so the first thing, not the only thing, but the first thing is I want this person to be saved. They don't have to do all of these things before they're saved. I had I've had Beckett Cook on before. You've probably
I know Beckett. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and he's awesome in this area too. But it's like I want to see them come to Christ, and then as you're pointing out, the Holy Spirit will convict them, and he might put me in their life to convict them and tell them the truth as well. But it's a lot different when it's kind of like the people have to know how much you care before they care what you know kind of thing. Like walking up to the atheist in a grocery store, or an atheist walking up to you and saying, here's why you should be an atheist.
Right.
It would, not only are you not going to change your mind, it'd kind of be really impulsive and probably dumb if you did. So to get to know people and to take it slowly and to befriend them and for them to know that you trust them and they trust you, and that even if you end up disagreeing and you can't change them, obviously you still love them. But that's a really important element to have this long-term thing rather than either you decide right now or you're gone. I'm glad you pointed that out, but
yep.
I think that's really helpful. I hope it's helpful for people listening, because if you haven't dealt with this to some degree, you're going to. It's almost certain. And especially if your kids are in school. And it's important to recognize that whether you're a parent or a youth pastor or a small group leader or involved in ministry to any degree, everything is not, like, we're not the be-all, end-all. It's not like you're the perfect preacher and the perfect psychologist and the perfect therapist and the perfect whatever. Sometimes you have to go and say, like you pointed out, this person needs actually needs a good therapist. Mm-hmm. And I can be there to counsel them to a degree, that the wonderful counselor lives in me, but I'm not a psychologist. And so
right.
it's like if a kid breaks their arm at flag football, I'm going to bring them to a hospital.
Right. Okay,
if they need a band-aid, I might be able to do that, but I'm going to have to bring them to the hospital with something more. I can't handle that. And that is something that has to happen at a point, and knowing where that line is tricky, but important. And, but yeah, that, I hope that's helpful for people listening.
Yeah.
Especially from a Christian standpoint.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. That was a great analogy, right? If they're lying on the side of the road, you're going to deal with the heart first, not these like peripheral things. The most important thing, and this is where I think Christians always get it wrong, is we always want to change people first. And the Bible says that the Holy Spirit works in us to will and to do for his good pleasure. You know, mm-hmm. like, and so connecting them to Christ will help make them Christ-like. And that is, we need to get that order straight. Speak truth. But ultimately, the ultimate truth is the salvation of their soul, and the Lord will deal with their heart and with their struggles.
Amen. Amen. And of course, if their leg is bleeding out now that they're alive, it'd be really unloving to leave it that way. Still,
right.
But the point is, now they're alive. So that's the first
right.
thing.
Right. But now the leg will matter. If they're alive, the leg yeah. matters.
Yeah. Now, before we go, you have a talk called "I Think Therefore I'm Trans" on mm-hmm. YouTube. I'll link it in the description. But you also said you have an article either that's out or that's coming out. What was that about?
Yeah, so it's on intersex, actually, and it's on our website, apologetics.org. It's one of the many articles that we have there, and you know, I'm an apologist. I'm not a biologist, but the culture has put me in a position where I had to study human biology on levels of which I never thought I would ever have to study these levels before. But the reason why I wrote this article, goodness, after studying intersection, probably 6-8 months or so, I don't even know, had to have multiple doctors review it. But the point is, you know, intersex is important, and it's usually one of the questions I get asked whenever we speak on the transgender question, right? It's the I in LGBTQIA. Right. So it's important. And people will say, well, doesn't intersex show that somebody can be both male and female, or that gender is fluid? And we have this misconception as to what intersex is. And so I would encourage people to read the article. I mean, I'll just say a little bit right now, and then I encourage people to read the article more. But what intersex is, in a really quick flyover level, it's referred to as DSDs, or differences of sexual development, or disorders of sexual development. From the medical community, that's the term they'll use. But basically, it's a way of describing somebody's anatomy that is atypical. Maybe their chromosomal makeup is atypical. But what intersex doesn't mean is that somebody's both male and female. We actually have no situations at all in humans where somebody's both male and female. Why? Because what determines whether you're male or female is not your chromosomes, but your gametes. In other words, whether you produce egg or sperm. So if you produce egg, large gametes, you're female; sperm, you're male. That is how, from a biological perspective, we determine male or female. Now, chromosomes are important and they are helpful, but it is not the sole way in which. And the reason why many biologists use gametes is because gametes is universal across species. So humans XXXY, we know that is XX is female, XY is male. We know that from like high school biology. But when you go to birds are, a female bird is ZW and a male is ZZ. So they use completely different chromosomes altogether. So XXXY isn't helpful when you cross over species. So, but a female bird will produce egg and a male will produce sperm. So it's consistent is looking at your gametes across species. And so somebody with an intersex condition is still, with the exception of, I would say, There's I would say probably two examples where we're like, they're not necessarily going in either direction, but the human body is always putting you on the pathway to be either male or female. It may not get there, but that's the direction it's going. And the whole, it may not get there, is where intersex comes into play. Intersex is when something, you know, maybe a particular extra chromosome that you have causes an alteration in the developmental process of you being able to produce a gamete or produce eggs, or it could cause, like, so there's, for example, there's one called MRKH, which basically happens when the internal, in females, where their internal reproductive system doesn't fully form, but their body was trying to, but then it didn't fully form. That is considered intersex. These women are still able to produce eggs, and so they are considered female. But that is what intersex is. It's a condition where something didn't go as it typically should in utero in development. There's another one called 5-ARD, where there's an issue with the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, which basically, if you want to think of dihydrotestosterone, it's basically like testosterone and steroids, basically. And in this particular male, that just it doesn't make that conversion. And that dihydrotestosterone is really important for external male genitalia to form. And so that means that this baby, their internal genitalia, this male internally forms fine, mostly, but there's some issues. But because of the dihydrotestosterone not forming correctly, they actually externally look slightly female, actually. And so the doctors maybe may even misidentify them as female. But, you know, puberty hits and then they get this massive dose of testosterone and doctors are giving them, you know, extra shots of testosterone and they can help correct some of the things that happened in utero. So the point is, though, their body is still moving this direction. Their body still produces sperm. And so they're still male. So intersex describes biological physical conditions that happen in the development of a particular baby, whether it's male or female. But what it doesn't do is say that somebody is both male and female. That does not exist in humans. And so it's not really a good argument to use for transgenderism.
That's really interesting. I'm going to have to check out that article. I'll link it in the description so other people can check it out below too. And of course, it's always odd when someone tries to use some kind of very rare case as like the crux of their argument. But I'll go ahead and link that in the description. I'm looking forward to checking that out as well.
Sure.
And thank you again, Alicia, so much for joining us on The Universe Next Door. It has been a long time coming, but glad we did it. It's an awesome episode, and I hope it's been helpful for people. I'm sure it has. It's helpful for me.
Yeah, no, well, and yeah, thank you so much for you know, dealing with this topic and addressing this topic. And for those of you who are listening, you know, like you know, you may want to unfollow after this, but understand nothing that I've quoted to you outside of the Bible pieces has been from any Christian sources. The statistics and the studies are all from non-Christian sources. The research that I've done is from non-Christian, because Christians really aren't leading the charge on this. It's the biologists, it's the journalists, it's the medical journals, it's these things that are leading the charge. Richard Dawkins, the world's most notorious atheist, is completely frustrated with the transgender issue because he's like, this is basic biology. You're either male or female. This is basic biology in his mind. And so the reason why I say that to you is this is not, before you think to unfollow, understand that this isn't about Christians versus the world. This is about humans who are concerned that maybe we are moving in a direction that is causing harm to our children and causing harm to adults. You know, young children are being sterilized because of the effects of the drugs that they're taking, only to have great remorse in their 20s. I mean, I've watched the videos of them crying, thinking, what have I done? I didn't know what I was doing at 13 and 14. And so the goal of talking about this isn't to make people, think that Christians hate transgender people. That's not true. I feel no different for someone who's trans than I do any other individual. It's just, what is it that we as Christians, knowing that what we know, knowing that what God has taught us, how can we help people who are struggling and are confused about who they are? That's all this simply is. Just like the culture is doing it, the Christians are doing it as well. And we just want people to know you don't have to take this route to find satisfaction with yourself. You can find satisfaction and peace with who you are when you place your identity out of the hands of the culture, which is a constantly moving pole, and you put it in the hands of God, who says your value doesn't change based on the length of your hair, the length of your nails, or how much facial hair you have. You are beautiful as you are, and you are worth me dying for. And I think there's no other way to demonstrate how much, you know, somebody values you than to give their life for you. And that's ultimately the goal of what I wanted to do today.
Definitely. I second that whole thing. And again, thank you for coming on to talk about this. It's been great. It's been very helpful. And both the YouTube, the episode on YouTube, I think Therefore I'm Trans will be in the description, and the article on intersex you just did. So check those out if you haven't. They're awesome. But thank you again, Alicia, so much for joining us. It's been awesome.
Thank you.
thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door. Don't forget to start sending in your questions now for our Q&A on the last Friday of the month. Send them to information@apologetics.org. Just so you don't have to rewind it, that's information@apologetics.org. They can be any kind of questions, faith, culture, religion related, whatever it may be. So send those in. And otherwise, don't forget to hit follow, and we'll see you back here next Tuesday night at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on The Universe Next Door.